I'm back with another episode of Startups for the Rest of Us. Today's episode is Hot Take Tuesday. I welcome back Einar and Tracy, and we talk about topics relating to bootstrapping and growing your company, including how mostly bootstrapped company Gymdesk sold for more than $32.5 million. And in fact, after we recorded this episode, I recorded an interview with the founder of Gymdesk that will air on this very feed in the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned for that. Today, we also talk about whether hiring is getting easier for bootstrappers, what changes in mindset might be present between founders at different MRR levels, how to identify what really moves the needle, and more Hot Take Tuesday topics. Before we dive in to the episode, if you're not on the email list for this show, you should head to startupsfortherestofus.com, enter your email. What you'll receive from there is a weekly email with the show notes and a recap of every episode with timestamps. You can, of course, opt out of that and still receive the less frequent emails we send. But you'll also receive two never-before-released episodes, 8 things you should know before launching your SaaS, and 10 things you should know as you grow your SaaS, as well as a PDF of the 5PM framework. In addition, I'm just wrapping up a book about selling your company. My wife, Dr. Sherry Walling, and I are in the final days of locking in that manuscript. And if you get on the email list here, you will hear about that book when it goes live. So with that, let's dive into Hot Take Tuesday. Welcome back to this Hot Take Tuesday roundtable. My first guest is someone you know very well, Tracy Makes on Twitter, our very own Tracy Osborne.
Hey, Tracy. Yeah.
Welcome.
Excited to be back.
It's been a while since Hot Take Tuesday. Bit of travel, bit of not a lot of news. I mean, even today, like, I like the docket today, but 2 or 3 of them are just questions that I think that,
it's,
you know,
a summer.
Yeah.
Slow
news
day. Yep. Yeah.
And my other panelist is Tiny Seed's very own Einar Volset. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's dive right into our first story. And we will link this up in the show notes. It's a PR Newswire article. It says Gymdesk announces a $32.5 million strategic growth investment from Five Elms Capital. Gymdesk, of course, being a Tiny Seed company.
Yeah.
So we are stoked about this. And I'm very happy for Iran, the founder. And, you know, I think the question I want to toss to you first, Einar, is, does this prove, or at least help to prove, our thesis of Tiny Seed, which is B2B SaaS companies are worth a lot of money. And even the little ones, even the tiny seeds and the micro comps, even, you know, they don't have to be unicorns to have enormous valuations. Obviously, raising at $32.5 million means this company is extremely valuable now. So talk us through your thinking.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't raise at $32.5 million. They raised $32.5 million. The valuation was even higher than that. And I think it's a great story. As we know, even the majority of our successful companies don't even necessarily raise any more money after us. But I think what this shows is that some of the tiny seed companies will grow into companies that will take this kind of money from growth private equity, where it's like, you know, I actually think a lot of people don't realize that sort of these software private equity growth capital funds even exist. They think like, okay, there's like VC and that's it. But realistically, once you get past about $1 million in ARR, there are, you know, pretty deep pools of capital that are interested in investing in these kind of companies and taking them further and taking them to the next level. So in that regard, it's very exciting for us. It's obviously very exciting for Ron and the team. And I think, you know, Tiny Seed, you know, we sold some of our equity in as part of the transaction, but we also rolled a substantial amount forward. And we expect them to just kind of keep growing. You know, the big player in the, so Gymdesk is obviously in the sort of gym management fitness space. The big player in the space is publicly traded Mindbody. Everyone in the space hates Mindbody. And I think there's a path to where Gymdesk basically becomes the better version of Mindbody and potentially is public down the line. So for us, it's very exciting.
And it's great as a founder to enter a space with a big incumbent that everyone hates and to be in a vertical. This is something I called back in January. I had my predictions for this year of like vertical SaaS and orthogonal SaaS are the places where we see a lot of opportunity for founders, not only to get in and carve out a space for themselves, but I would posit that exiting and the valuations can likely be higher than if you're building a big horizontal thing.
I think that's true. I mean, I think in general, too, I see this in the discretion capital side. Like, we see the appetite for, you know, M&A and outcomes is substantially higher for sticky vertical SaaS where there's, you know, high recurrence, low churn. You know, obviously they want growth, but they don't need to have 500, 600% year-over-year growth to have a business that is backable or acquirable at that size. And it's one of those things like, look, Jimdesk, they raised his money at a huge valuation, but the only other money they raised was from us. That was it.
Right. And I wonder if this means they're no longer mostly bootstrapped, because that's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. And just so people have an idea before I kick it to Tracy, A&R mentioned Discretion Capital. He is the founder of Discretion Capital, which is an M&A advisory for B2B SaaS companies doing 2 to 25 million ARR. And Discretion represented Iran and Jimdesk in this transaction.
Yes, indeed.
Tracy, what's your take on this whole deal?
To repeat what Einar said, it was the whole private equity path. When I was a startup founder and when I first started TinySeed, I didn't realize that was an option. And I've been seeing articles, I've been hearing Einar talk about this for the last few years. And then I've been seeing articles in the last few months about more people talking about the current economic climate when it comes to venture capital and how private equity is becoming more of an option or more of a something where people want to go for. People are more aware of it, and it's more of a desirable option for a lot of companies that are wanting to exit. So it's really cool to see a example about on this directly from TinySeed. And I think this is a great example to other founders out there who might be struggling with traditional VC to kind of look at this direction. Because I think there's some folks who are just like, private equity, you know? And I think there's cases like this where you can see where private equity can position Jimdesk and give them resources they need to go up against something like Mindbody.
Yeah, I think it's true. I mean, I think like fundamentally, a lot of people have a view of private equity as like from a Bruce Springsteen song. It's like, you know, they came to town, they bought the factory, shut it down, and now my father's an alcoholic type thing. But sort of what this proves, and look, Jimdesk isn't the first company, that TinySeed company that did this. We've had at least, you know, one or two more. And we think, given the number of companies that we're backing and how they're growing, we're expecting more and more companies to decide that they'll get to a million or two or five or whatever, and decide that, you know, whatever got us here won't get us there. And like having more capital and in some cases, advice and experience to go from, say, 5 to 50 million in ARR is a viable path. And I also think that there are more sort of companies that started out on sort of the IPO VC path and have built substantial businesses that sort of make sense. They're doing 2 or 5 or 10 million or more, and they realize like they're not growing it. I think it's Gary Tan who put out some stat like about 2023 is like the medium growth rate you had to have to be a successful Series A VC, raise a Series A VC round in 2023 was 600% year-over-year growth. But
a lot of companies aren't going to hit
that. That's not the only path.
Right.
Yeah, that's not the only path. Look, there are companies out there, there are investors, certainly you probably have to be at a reasonable scale. Like the fundamental thing about private equity is like they care more about downside protection than VC does. But the flip side is, if you can provide that downside protection by being at a certain scale, then the kind of outcome that they're looking for, 3 to 5x in 3 to 5 years, might be better and more aligned with what it is that you want to do with your life. It's sort of like the way that I put it in one of the projects I got going called Next Catalyst is, do you want to be rich or do you want to be king? Because there are some people who basically the thing they care the most about is to be famous. They want to be known as like the Elon Musk of the world. They want to be known as like an amazing startup founder that succeeded and rang the bell at NASDAQ. And then there's the rest of us who's like, you know what? I'd rather just be rich.
On to our next topic, with layoffs and back to the office in effect. Is it getting easier for bootstrappers to hire? Tracy, what is the word on the street? We have 171 investments across TinySeed, B2B SaaS, almost 300 founders now. What's the word that you're hearing in terms of hiring difficulty or ease compared to the last couple of years?
That's an interesting question. Actually, I'm not sure if I have like specific stats on that. I have a lot of gut feelings. I mean, hiring is always hard,
feelings,
right?
Are fun.
Yeah, hiring is always going to be hard. And with the folks who are used to working from home and they want to have those benefits of working at home, there's, you know, pros and cons in all of this where these giant companies want people to go back to the office. And so they could be looking for, you know, might be easier to find these folks who are wanting to work from home, and might be easier to find those folks that work at those big companies. However, the other thing that I think I've heard about is also the mindset of these potential employees and whether they fit within a bootstrap company, because a bootstrap company is not going to be pay well as one of these giant companies. There's going to be a lot of benefits like working from home and like the flexibility that you would get that people might have gotten used to when in this era of being able to work from home. But bootstrap companies are going to have to work a little bit differently. So there's like some pros and cons there for the folks who are trying to find these workers. It might be easier to find people, but they might not have the right mindset.
To give you some data, we just released the State of Independent SaaS report for 2024. Folks can download that at stateofindysaas.com. And in it, let's see, I'm on page 18. It says 85% of companies we surveyed, so we surveyed almost 700 bootstrap, mostly bootstrap SaaS companies, all microconf, tiny seed type companies. 85% reported that the difficulty in hiring people is either the same or easier than last year. And that feels about right. Like most people are saying it's same or easier. In addition, this was the first year where we saw hiring, maybe it was the first time we surveyed because it was 2 years ago, but we see that 30% fewer companies are hiring or hired in 2023 compared to 2021. And again, this is bootstrap companies. We know there was a big VC bubble and there was a lot of hiring and now there's layoffs, but it certainly happens across our type of bootstrap companies as well. And the plan to hire in the next 12 months was down 17%. So even though it, to me, like anecdotally, and obviously, you know, from these numbers, it appears that it is easier for bootstrappers to hire. I think a lot due to what I already mentioned, which was like, there's a bunch of layoffs and there's a lot of back to the office. And that's all being remote has always been a bootstrapper advantage. Einar Volset, you have anything to add?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, I think like certainly the return to work is part of it. I also think like there's less competition from the larger firms who like, you know, back in the boom days were just hoovering up every talent and not talent in the world. And like, you know, that's not been happening and layoffs has been happening. And so people aren't just like, why would I ever work for a bootstrap thing? Anyone can get a job paying crazy money at like, you know, big co. Those days are not there anymore. So that might be part of it too.
Our next topic is a question from Twitter. And I don't know if I want to answer the exact question. So the question is from @sunglassesface. Name is Orly. What change in mindset do you notice between founders with 100 MRR, 1,000 MRR, 10,000 MRR, or 100,000 MRR? And the reason I want to change the question is we've watched dozens of founders hit all of those milestones and they're the same founder. The mindset doesn't shift that much. Like look at a Ruben Gomez or, you know, a Ron Galperin with Gymdesk. It's like the mindset from the start was do things really fast, ship a lot of be mostly correct, be right most of the time, have a good gut feel. And you do that when you're at 100 and you do that when you're at 100,000 MRR. So, but I don't think that's what Orly Sunglasses Face is asking. I almost think the question is, how do the challenges that you face differ from 100 to 1,000 to 10,000 to 100,000 MRR?
Well, I think it's just it's a misconception because some folks, I think when they're at the early stage, it's like, is my mindset wrong? Is the reason why I'm not growing, is it because of my mindset? And so, you know, I think that question stems from this misconception, and that's what you're trying to explain. I just wanted to kind of harp on that thing is that, you know, there's a lot of things to do. It's not necessarily just mindset. You have to have like a growth mindset, but that growth mindset is going to be there at every stage.
I agree. And with that in mind, Einar, what do you think the changes are? We don't even have to go through all four of these, but like when someone's at 100 MRR versus 10,000 MRR, let's contrast those to start. What are the different challenges?
I don't know. At that stage, I don't know that there is a difference, like, because it's, I think it's not that different. I think it's just like, let's just do it. Like there's a right, I think, strongly opinionated, there's a right mindset and it's just move fast and just do a lot of shit and just like when it working, keep doing more of the stuff that's working. I think what I observe, and maybe it's because of, you know, how I operate and what I do, I think there's a more of a break at above even these numbers of what he's talking about. Like, I think like what we very commonly see is, I think a lot of people, whether they're at 100 or 10,000 or whatever MRR, they're like, they have this view that like, oh, once I get to 1 million in ARR, 83.33, whatever it is in MRR, then everything would be great. Like, that's it. I've made it. Like, it just, I just need to do more of the thing that I've already proven to make it. And actually, Jason Cohen did a great piece on this, talking about, well, I think he called it the elephant curves or something like that. And it's basically the myth of exponential, continuous exponential growth. And what he says is, like, I think he uses the example of HubSpot. He says, like, look, it looks from the outside like it's just is like up and to the right graph. And like, that's how they did it. They just did more of whatever it was that was working. But actually, if you look underneath the covers, it's like one growth curve stacked on top of the other, where it's basically like they launched a new product and then they added another channel and then they launched another product and like another channel. And I think the biggest mindset change that I've observed repeatedly is people, once they get past about $1 million in ARR, or two or three, they get to the stage, they're like, oh, like my growth is stalling out now. Like what I was working, like my market's saturated, my niche is saturated. And the mindset change becomes like, okay, I got to do something new again. You know, like not just the thing that was working. I got to go after another thing and another thing and another thing. And that's, I think, is the biggest mindset change. And the people who fail to do that, quite often, they end up in a situation where, because all sort of growth decays over time, they end up in a scenario where, like, they have a great business that's growing 100%, and then they have a great business growing 40%, and then they have a great business that's growing 15%, and then they have a business that's not really growing, and then it starts to decline, and now they're like, crap, I should have sold this a couple of years ago. I think that happens a fair bit.
Tracy, what do you think about these revenue MRR levels? Do you agree with ANR? He was saying 100 to 1,000 is, or 100 to 10,000 is similar, because I think there's a difference at 10,000, but I'm curious to hear what you think between these levels.
Yeah, it's like, well, I have my notes was, you know, early stage is, you know, finding product market fit. Middle stage is pouring fuel on those areas that work, and then later stage is broadening out. And so just agreeing with what ANR says, and I've seen this as well, is that folks get to that certain level of 1 million in ARR and they're like, now what? I don't want to do it again. And it's like, yeah, you have to like figure out how to like do it again, but in a different area. And so I guess that's a mindset thing, as of just that growth mindset of being aware that you're going to have this wonderful growth, and the mindset of knowing that it will end, and therefore being able to react or like prevent it and react appropriately before that down curve happens. And that is something that we've seen a lot of folks run into that trap.
Right, looking ahead at your plateaus.
Mm-hmm. Like, don't wait till the plateau happen.
Yeah, I talk about it in three phases, and there are more than this, but like the first phase is building a product, second phase is building a business, third phase is building a company. And usually I think of product as being zero up to usually about 10K MRR, to be honest. It's like, I have a product, I'm trying to figure out, does anybody want this? Can I sell it? What's the pricing like? You're just fumbling. You have almost no product market fit or very weak product market fit. Between 10 and 20, I feel like, oh, now I have revenue. I'm probably going to have expenses. Like, I kind of have to start thinking about this as a real business a bit. And then I think from that point up until somewhere in the 50 to 100K, that's where you're building the business. And then 50 to 100K, I think you're building a company. That's when it's like, I need really good people. I probably need to start thinking about hiring managers and delegating a lot more, because usually in a SaaS company, you know, you have a lot of folks on your team.
Not going to be the first person on the ground anymore.
Yeah.
Relying on other people. Yeah, a lot of things are going to change at that point. Mm-hmm. And the mindset to be aware and ready for those changes too.
Hiring senior developers can really move the needle in your business, but if you bring on the wrong person, you can quickly burn through your runway. If you need help finding a vetted, senior, results-oriented developer, you should reach out to today's sponsor, Lemon.io. For years, they've been helping our audience find high-quality global talent at competitive rates, and they can help you too. Don't just take my word for it. Listener Dylan Pierce had this to say about working with Lemon.io. The machine learning engineer they helped me hire was very professional and even learned a new tech stack to set up an environment to train and deploy machine learning models. He documented his work clearly so I could train it in the future with additional data. I'm super happy with the results. And longtime listener Chaz Yoon hired a senior developer from Lemon.io and said his hire, quote, definitely knew his stuff, provided appropriate feedback and pushback, and had great communication, including very fluent English. He really exceeded my expectations. Chaz said he'd definitely use Lemon.io again when he's looking for a senior level engineer. To learn more and get a 15% discount on your first 4 weeks of working with a developer, head to lemon.io/startups. That's lemon.io/startups. Our next topic is how to identify what really moves the needle. This is a question from Sander Fish on X Twitter, and it was asked directly of me. I posted, I don't know, it was about a month ago, and said, hey, ask some more intermediate and advanced questions. And I like this one. Sander Fish says, often it feels like SaaS success is an accumulation of many small decisions and improvements over time, which I would 100% agree with. How do you identify what really moves the needle? Tracy Makes, how do you identify?
I like that Einar brought up earlier in the last question, talking about like the founders constantly working on new things and getting things done. And in that, folks also need to be, they don't need to lose track of analyzing how well those things do. And that doesn't have to be that hard. You know, as things are going through, make sure that you're adding the right like referral links or whatnot, so that as you're setting up these marketing campaigns and working on three things at once, that later on you can spend, you know, 15 minutes going back and being like, all right, cool, I did these three things. Now I can like track all these things that are happening. You know, and sometimes people can get into this thing where they're like, got launch, do things. And then it's like, what actually was working? What was actually worth the amount of time that you were spending on this? And you have to remember to do maybe like a monthly cadence of looking back at what you have done in that month and then analyze what things are happening. So you actually can identify what's moving that needle. And that's hard to do as a founder because you have to be constantly launch. And it's really easy to forget to do that analyzing process.
What do you think, Einar? How do you identify what really moves a needle?
I sort of think like, while important, it's more important just to do more shit. And then if things are going well, then great. So I think there's two hurdles for most founders that I see that I work with. The main problem isn't trying to figure out what's working. It's doing enough experiments so that something is working. And like, look, if they make a bunch of, if they do 25 things and then two or three of them are working, but they're not totally sure which ones are working, but they're just kind of doing it, that's much better than what most people do, which is like they overanalyze and do two things and neither of them work or goes backwards. That being said, I do think it's important, like to Tracy's point, like once you have some stuff, like you got to be like, that is working, it's got to be like, okay, what do I double down on? Like, what is it that's really working? Because the other thing that I mistake see people make is like, they'll read the traction book from Gabriel Weinberg and they'll try a bunch of things and like something's working. And then they figure out that something's working, but then they won't really double down on it and try to squeeze everything out of it and really explore how big that success can be. And instead they sort of wander off and pick something else to do. And then another thing. And like, it's the point where like, look, like this was working, like just double down on the thing and just make sure you squeeze the full growth out of it.
It's like shiny object syndrome. Where it's like, because it is really fun to launch a new marketing campaign, right? And so yeah. It's just like, ooh, how to set up this thing, how to learn a new thing and do this kind of thing. And yeah, and forgetting to really track on and follow up on those things.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people have this, like once they have this working, I know that I do this sometimes. It's like, if they have something that's working, they're always like, great, it's working. I always know that I can rely on that and do more of it if it's working. So I'm just not going to do that because I have it in my back pocket. And then I'm going to go do these other things and explore more so I have more things in my back pocket. And like, I think that's a mistake most of the time. It's like, particularly for growth channels and things like that, it's like, no, this is working now, but you have no idea. Does it work 50% more? Does it work 5,000 times more? You don't know until you really try. So I think that's a mistake people make.
Yeah, it's funny. Tracy said launching a new marketing campaign is fun. So is launching a new product. So is just building more. So is writing features. Like, I think there are a lot of rules of thumb and a lot of frameworks and guidelines that like I talk about on this show, we talk about in MicroConf and obviously to Tiny Seed companies that are in my book, whatever. These, you should probably listen to them in most cases if you don't know anything else. It's like, this is a great start. It's like, learn the rules, then master the rules so that you know when to break them. But if you never learn the rules, then you don't know that you shouldn't start a B2C two-sided marketplace with freemium and, you know, launch 7 products and blah, 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 and try to do viral marketing on my social media following and think I'm going to build some incredible business, right? It's not impossible what I just said, but the odds are stacked dramatically against you. So listen to those who have gone before you. And when I think about trying to figure out what's going to move the needle, usually I think, what has moved the needles for others? A million things I could do, but founders who have it working, what are they doing? And then try to generalize that. So I look at the best, most successful founders. I mean, I was doing this as I was coming up and saying, what's Jason Cohen doing? What is Heaton Shaw doing? What is, you know, these people who are building incredible businesses and are not, you have to discount it. They're not Steve Jobs and they're not Elon Musk, right? I'm a bootstrapper. I can't model myself after those people. I can't even model myself after Basecamp because I didn't launch a SaaS in 2004 that gets, what did they say, 10,000 trials a month or something? It's just, I'm not in that situation. They can do stuff like not market, like not sell, because they're in a luxurious position, and good for them. You know, the luck and timing were one and two. Jason Fried told me that for their success. Unless I can replicate luck and timing, I can't. Then I need to look at folks who do it and grind it and figure it out. Like Iran from Gymdesk, like Ruben from Signwell. Like, you know, there's dozens and dozens of tiny seed founders that I would look at and try to model. That's why I write this S playbook. Like, you can buy it for $10 on Kindle. Like, read through that. And if I were to try to prioritize stuff, I would start with the stuff in that book, not the stuff that I see people yapping about on Twitter, right? The approach is where it's like, build an audience. Yeah, great. That's fun. But it's not for your SaaS company. Build your network, not your audience. So I don't know. I prioritize things by first trying to have some type of framework to limit its infinity things I could try down to 20, 50. There's only that many. And then I would, if I have a gut feel, a strong gut feel, I would do it myself. Otherwise, I would get people involved. I'd say, Einar, what do you think I should do? I'd say, Tracy, Ruben, Iran, what do you think I should do? People in my mastermind, advisors, whoever, what do you think? I'm down to this list of three now. Which should I try first? You know, get an outside counsel and then go for it.
Yeah, it helps get you out of that tunnel vision and out of that, ooh, I'm really excited about doing one thing because that'd be more fun versus the other thing that'll actually move the needle.
That's the thing that I talk about this all the time, where it's the ice cream versus spinach. And you know what's really yummy is ice cream. And I want to lose weight, but I want to eat ice cream and not spinach. Those two don't go together. So when someone tells me, I want to grow a SaaS company, great, here's my advice. Blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, but I want to do B2C and I want to launch 7 products and see what sticks. I'm like, so you want to eat ice cream and think that you're going to be, that's my analogy that I make, you know? And so implicit in this question, how do you identify what really moves the needle? Honestly, what moves the needle is often not ice cream. What moves the needle is often not what we want to do, unfortunately. There are examples of folks who did exactly what they want. It's like the one person who like built a social media following, and maybe there's like three, built a social media following and like also just writes a lot of code and that works. And we all want to do that as builders. But usually what moves the needle is not that.
And because, I mean, like the reason everyone's heard of them is because it's noteworthy.
Exception.
It's yep. Like, holy moly, look at this guy. He's on the beach in Thailand and he's got 7 products and they're making $50,000 each and it's working really well. Everyone's like, oh, I got to follow this guy. Look at this. Well, yeah, but for each one of those guys, there's 500 people who are running million ARR, 5 million ARR, 100 million ARR businesses that did nothing of that.
Yeah, it's a trip. It's a survivor bias. And I'm not taking anything away from people who've made that work, but it really reminds me of, you know, a rock star or someone who gets into the NBA. Like there's 500 NBA players, I believe, approximately. And it's like how many people each year try to get into the NBA. And that's what this feels like. It's that hit-based, you're decreasing your odds. Those are not the things you should be working on. The blocking and tackling of what we talk about on this podcast and what we talk about at MicroConf and what I put in my books is...
Can you tackle in basketball? Is that allowed?
I switched metaphors to sports, sports ball, to football.
Sports ball.
Nerd.
Blocking and tackling in basketball would be hilarious. We should do that.
We should have full contact basketball.
There you go.
And on that note, we are going to wrap up today's Hot Take Tuesday. Tracy Osborne, you are Tracy Makes on Twitter and also one of the folks behind the @TinySeedFund Twitter account. X-Twitter is what I'm calling it now. But
it actually works out pretty well when you say X-Twitter, you know?
It's like EX-Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yep. Used to be. Company formerly known
as.
Because when I say X, it's like, what are you talking about? So I keep saying X Twitter. Einar Volset, you are Einar Volset on Twitter, mostly tweeting about the San Francisco Giants.
The San Francisco Giants, who are playing really badly at the moment, but we'll turn it around.
It's possible. Sure. It could happen. Thanks, you two. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Tracy and Einar for joining me on the show this week. And thanks to you for listening to Startups for the Rest of Us, whether you've heard 6 episodes, 60 episodes, or 600. It's great to have you back. I enjoy spending every week in your earbuds. This is Rob Walling signing off from episode 727.